Chapter 3, Rage and Silence. He was North Hollywood's answer to Paco de Lucía, renowned flamenco guitarist. On stage, he would sit in the classical style, one foot raised to support his instrument, long blonde hair falling sweaty in his face. He did not look at the audience, except perchance through the matted locks as he raised a glass of wine to his lips. Had people glimpsed beneath the hair, they would have seen an expression that was both painful and ecstatic. Then again, people never saw. He neither spoke nor sang one word during a performance. He hardly moved during a one-hour set, other than hands and head shaking in time to the intense flourish of notes that were wrung from his guitar. Melodies, structured phrases, and improvised sections peppered each song with the very fiber of his soul. He was a talented player, fusing an array of complex styles. He played with the heavier strings, frequently out of stock, always on order. He struck them harder than most, and routinely broke one or more per show. Every note mattered, and he played like a madman, a whirling dervish without the motion, yet driven by that same frenzied energy, as if those were his last moments on earth. It was essential to be the best at all times, and if he were to expire by the end of the song, if the audience's only snapshot of him was that final hurrah, that would be enough. It was not until he stood that he revealed his build. Tall, slim, yet muscular. Broad shoulders squeezed into a close-fitting matador jacket, pants pulled way up tight around a slender waist, giving him the look of a lot of leg and little body. Though there was a hint of something feminine, maybe the hair, the clothes that outlined every nook and cranny, or the overly poised and pursed-lipped manner in which he sat, he was, regardless, a real hunk. Imagine the guitar hero of Antonio Banderas' El Mariachi, only with a blonde mane, and there you have him, an exotic creature. This was indeed a contrast to the man standing beside him on stage, also playing acoustic guitar, though in his case, singing and strumming basic chords. Here was no gorgeous-faced guitar god. This man was small and compact with close-cropped hair and a cheeky, winning way. He was easy in his communication with the audience and uninhibited in a bluesy pop singing style. Rage and Silence, as they were called, would finish a show and invariably someone would approach with a consensus.
Oh, I see, you're Rage and wait a minute, let me guess, you're Silence, right?
What few people knew was that he was both Rage and Silence. The name of the act was coined by his songwriting partner after the two moods of El Virtuoso. Ironically, even our man, Mr. R and S, did not know the truth. He just thought it a great name. Rage and Silence, a perfect dichotomous visual of the two men. His two passions in life were on that stage, playing the guitar and drinking red wine. Vast amounts of red, and while we're at it, white wine, beer, gin, vodka, whiskey, tequila, martini, liqueur, in fact anything alcoholic he could get his hands on. All and in any order, down the hatch. I have never seen anyone drink so many different types of alcohol during the course of an evening and still play a set of music relatively unaffected. Amazing. Especially so, as the next morning he had to go to work as a mover.
Movers! Movers are here!
And that was where I met him. I know it was brutal for him playing a gig the night before, doing what he felt was a true calling, performing and drinking, and then moving furniture the next day, a rude awakening. He cut a particular figure at work, too. He'd never wear shorts or the company tee, but favoured thick hooded sweatshirts and pants, even in temperatures of 100 degrees plus. The sweatshirt principle was a triple whammy. Long, punishing work days, sometimes with the hood down, boxing style, would refresh the body and soul.
Cleans out the toxins from the night before, Artie.
Well, according to R&S, anyway. The workout helped keep the figure svelte and toned. In addition, he feared the effects of sun damage to his lily-white skin. He applied a sun-block moisturizer generously to guard face and hands. To further protect his number one concern, a pair of durable gauntlets were used on the harsh aspects of a move. dirty patio furniture, plants, garden paraphernalia, garage miscellaneous, etc. Practical, though a tad pretentious, had the gauntlets been worn by a knight preparing to joust, they would have only been slightly out of place because of the material, certainly not because of the look. He believed the glove-wear hoodie ensemble to be just the ticket for any moving gig, any climate. To a third party, he would have appeared simply overdressed and hot. R&S would never eat on a job, even if the customer bought lunch, choosing to wait for a healthy evening meal. He drank only distilled water from a gallon jug and on occasion would buy a malt beer at lunchtime, I suspect to keep the jitters at bay. He was in trouble at the start of a job once, hands trembling and face pale, shining with a heavy glaze. A skinful of booze, an overdose of moisturising cream. Well, both actually. Add to the mix a heavy-lidded look-right-through-you stare and a splash of sweat on the top lip, shake vigorously, and voila. A present but absent demeanour that was downright scary. Hey, pale face, anyone home? He was a vain man, way more so than most, and had embarked on the electrolysis-style removal of facial hair, but ran out of money an inch above his Adam's apple. That morning saw him silent and vacant as the remaining telltale line of whiskers started to inch their way forward as if screaming, "Hey, what about me?" for another $1,000 to finish the job. We pulled up in front of the house of the day. I could see he was struggling. "Dude, why don't you let me go through the paperwork with the customer? Get yourself sorted." I was in the truck when he returned a little later. He shuffled to the side, where panels allow furniture to be tied down, and rested forehead against wood. "So, everything cool?" I supposed I was waiting for an answer. I wasn't quite sure. I tried to look but couldn't see anything could be going on behind the hair. There was a quiet knocking sound. He was rocking back and forth against the panel. I waited, half smiling, expected a funny line or something. Then I noticed the mandatory paper bag. This was a first, drinking on the trucks. "I see you got yourself something a little stronger than Starbucks, dude." In a voice so low, he mouthed a favourite line from the movies. "That'll wake you up in the morning, boys." Gradually, the contents of the brown bag returned him to the land of functioning and reporting for duty. Over the years, I socialised with him outside the work environment. I supported his musical endeavours as he did mine. He played on a couple of my recorded tracks. I watched him perform live. I made fun of his mannered playing style, choosing to sit like the flamenco masters rather than stand. "Hey, flamenco boy! Techno man! What's up?" I liked him when he wasn't the wild-eyed absentee of the morning after. He could be witty, playful, almost tender. He was a generous host to friends when he had the dough, and though his work schedule was sketchy, credit shot and cash flow always an issue, he was never without a glass of wine, almost always red. He respected my opinion and seemed to like me. I found out how much after a particular night of drunken revelry. "I'd take a bullet for you, man." I was bemused at the sudden change of pace. I wasn't even sure I'd heard him right, but I did. I looked over for the visual, and as quickly as the emotion had come, it disappeared in a trice, as if embarrassed at letting his guard down, or something. It was an uncommonly candid moment, and in time I came to understand the significance of the terms he'd used, a flashback to a surprisingly violent past that plagued his dreams, turned them into nightmares, and jolted him awake in a cold sweat, open-mouthed and silent shrieking. Flamenco boy. Legendary shenanigans. We didn't work together much. He was driver, as was I, but his antics were legendary. The stuff that after-dinner show-stopping yarns are made of. The management had a problem scheduling him. They said he was unreliable and tried to rein in his erratic work ethic, but he was an unbridled force that would not be corralled. He'd work 2 or 3 days, then disappear for a week or two. He'd reappear without any excuse, desperate for cash, and as moving companies are ever in need of competent drivers, they'd accept him back. Reluctantly, though. He was engaging with the public and could pour on the charm, but would turn on a dime if they were rude or testy. He believed a firm hand was required when dealing with an unreasonable customer. There was the odd confrontation at the start of a job. Men or women, used to taking charge, not packed and ready to move, or a little too specific in their needs from a mover. He'd let them know immediately what to expect. If they complained, off he'd go. No discussion. Wouldn't even start the job. I was called in more than once to cover a gig that flamenco boy had walked off. I began to recognise a pattern here. As he hated the fact that he earned his living from moving and not music, he did the bare minimum to skate by. His needs were modest, and once he'd made his money for the month, he'd vanish. I suspected that if he'd given his word to work and then realised he'd already reached his existence quota, he'd get short-tempered and resentful. The only reason he needed to walk off a job was if he took an instant dislike to the shipper, and no entreaties from the office could change his mind. However, Flamenco never pulled this stunt when funds were low. On an occasion when he decided to walk out on a real bitch, Artie, the news of possible conflict had been discussed by the packing crew from the day before. In the office, they'd described the woman as demanding and unreasonable. Maybe Mr. R and S was not the best candidate to move her. Management was in a tight spot, no one else available. So they crossed their fingers and hoped for the best. Things went badly from the outset. Shipper and mover got into it first thing. She dove straight into complaining about minor details of the pack job. Said they'd do this, didn't do that, me, 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 wah, wah, wah. What she didn't know was that Flamenco Boy had reached his target wage for the month. He was sporting his classic morning after hue and was in no mood for protracted, petty wrangling. Listen, I am not part of the packing crew. Today I am here to move you. Now, do you want me to stay or leave? You decide. Normally, this stock response from our man cooled the heels of many a prickly pear. The chances of getting a replacement mover on the day is unlikely, so it shifts the balance of power to the mover and things calm down. Usually. Still in complaint mode, however, she called in to bitch at the company. Flamenco received a call from the office urging calm, only to catch a remark of hers in the background. That was it. He'd had enough. He was being attacked on both sides now, and he just came unglued. He was alternately shouting at her, then screaming obscenities at the office via the telephone. He started hammering the phone up and down on its cradle, up and down. Then he held the phone by the mouthpiece to get more leverage, more bang for his buck, you might say, and, still screaming obscenities, began to renew his assault on the machine for a full 10 seconds, his long hair rocking back and forth as he smashed it into oblivion, his oblivion. Finally, it all subsided, and everyone, movers and customer, was frozen, silent and shocked. Well, it is shocking when someone wigs out to the nth degree in a relatively unprovoked manner. Flamenco Boy came too, holding the receiver, resplendent with dangling earpiece, and put it down gently. One finger remained on the phone and he paused, confused, as if considering, how did this come to be damaged? And with a prissy flick of his head, he sniffed, okay, I'm off. The office had to mop up that mess, and I'm not sure what happened next. I only know that after repeated attempts to admonish his behaviour, they were met with a nonplussed mover who was unrepentant. She deserved it, was all he would say. They put him on suspension, which suited him just fine. Time off to play the guitar, drink red wine, and he'd made his money mark. Nice. I approached him afterwards. So, dude, that's what you call a firm hand when dealing with the public, is it? Jesus! He was looking away, leaning on elbows with a quiet finger on puckered lips, but his eyes flashed at me and smirked. There were other incidents, though not as extreme. One traffic occurrence saw him blocking a guy and his car in with a 26-foot moving truck. Leaping like a gazelle onto the hood of the vehicle, he dared the driver to get out and face it like a man. All right, I take that back, the extreme reference, that is. You, God forbid, dear listener, are in a small car, late for work. You do something silly to get by a moving van. I mean, it's big and slow and, anyway, it's over. You didn't do it on purpose, no harm, no foul. Suddenly, the big truck pulls in front of you at an angle, taking up two lanes of highway. Now you're stuck. out gets Tarzan with a shock of hair, and he's on the hood of your car.
Oh my God, he's on the...
You have no fucking idea who you're fucking dealing with! Throw down, boy!
Another time, I was with him in the truck, and he asked me to pull over, and disappeared. I found myself zoning out, hitting the seek button on the radio, looking across the road into a group of shops. Stationery, liquor store. Oh look, a Thai place. I wonder if it's any good. A bunch of random thoughts, really. On the other side of the street, a man had gone into the paper store, vaulted the counter and confronted an employee. He seemed to be threatening him with a series of finger-jabbing motions. Familiar locks were swaying as if giving prominence to certain words. The aggressor then grasped his victim by the shirt, hauled him forward and spat in his face. For one tiny moment, the world stood still. He held him close, eyeball to eyeball, allowing the employee to feel his rage, and then thrust him back against a wall, dispatched in the contemptuous manner one would flick away a loathsome insect. Even at a distance, I could see the guy was terrified. That was all it took. The man with the hair turned on his heel and marched out. Mission accomplished.
You see, Artie, the art of the threat is quite simple. Never threaten anyone. Beat them to death, then dare them to do it again.
Stationery guy had been mildly but sexually flirting with Flamenco's girlfriend. She had not reciprocated and felt vaguely threatened. So our man decided to pay dude a visit. I supposed he had just made good on his earlier maxim. Back in the truck, it was a while before he spoke. He knew I suspected something as I kept looking over, yet he just kept his gaze straight ahead. I couldn't stand it any longer.
So, did you beat him to death and dare him to do it again?
He took a deep breath.
Put it this way, I don't think he'll be coming back to the post office for quite a while.
A smile appeared on his lips for a job I'm sure he considered well done.
Post office? Dude, I thought you said she was a stripper.
Ha! Ba-da-da-da-da-da! Woo!
We burst into our favourite song with the ferocity that he had displayed moments earlier and were still vocally air-guitaring as we pulled into the yard at the end of the day. We got a lot of mileage out of that incident. While Flamenco added a few inches to Stationery Guy's collar size, I was informed of the corresponding audio.
I didn't realise she had a boyfriend.
In time, I found myself acting out the stunned employee scenario and was able to work in Flamenco's other classic, Get Out and Face It Like a Man. I tried them in a number of styles, but inevitably returned to the original delivery. They were received with smirks and snickers, and the ritual became a term of endearment, even greeting between us. Strange the things that bond us to others. I have to say I was ambivalent regarding his violent behaviour. All three incidents were unacceptable conduct. This time, however, there was a certain rough justice to it. He may have gone too far, but was reacting to an injustice that was first dealt to him. I had a fleeting admiration for a man who'd take matters into his own hands in order to protect his own and not hide behind the skirts of another. There's something exhilarating about being with someone who appears not to conform to the same social constraints as the rest of us. It's like hanging out with a superhero. Though Flamenco Boy was more of a dark avenging vigilante, nothing is out of bounds. You can do anything you like. Ultimately, it's frightening. Unless the person has a just code of ethics, a clearly defined grasp of right and wrong, any act is justifiable. In light of these events, I'm not sure he did. It was possibly only a matter of time before something seriously fucked up would happen. I knew him through at least three girlfriends, androgynous types with short hair and common sense personalities. He was their beautiful idol whom they worshipped. After 3 months or so, when the Best Behaviour Act was dropped, they realised a sleek predator had been invited in to stay, and it was too late. They were smitten and he would not move on till he was ready. And when he did, the place and the relationship was in a shambles. He would have unwarranted fits of rage and destroy doors, walls and furniture. He was a parasite with a poor credit profile. His chick MO was to move in on a woman that was already set up. Place to live, nice car, good secure job, all accounts and bills up to date and in her name. a relationship in decline. Our relationship began to sour when he accused me of sleeping with one of his girlfriends. Utterly paranoid and silly, really, as his manly choice in a mate could not have been further from my own. Plus, he was a friend. He had actively encouraged the friendship between the girlfriend and I, independent of him being around, and this was his reaction. He seemed to be setting us up for some reason. I convinced him his conjecture was unfounded, but it began to dawn on me that his volatile temper could quite easily turn on old Artie boy. I may have been lucky due to the fact that I simply hadn't got in the way. Until now, perhaps. I was further implicated in his turmoil. Mimicking my accent to a prospective one-night stand had the poor girl believing he came from Britain. He made his move in my presence. It so came out of nowhere without warning that I almost laughed in his face. But he was serious. His attempt sounded ridiculous, a la Dick Van Dyke in Mary Poppins. "All right, my lady." A sort of halting 18th century London chimney sweep dialect. Please. However, the flavour was there, and unless you were a somewhat Anglophile, you may not have known. In order not to embarrass him publicly, I went along with it. His motive in the deception? To appear cultured, debonair, a British rocker perhaps. Who knows? It was bizarre. I mean, it was not as if he had trouble betting chicks on the strength of his looks and charm. What kind of game was he playing? He called it just a bit of fun, but it wasn't. Their liaison was ongoing and the fun became a lie. I purposefully stayed out of the way, but got caught by shrapnel. She and I shared a table at one of his gigs. "When the two of you were in that band together in England..." "What?" "That band, in England, the two of you." Jeez, I've got to get out of this. I was a polite enabler, allowing his poor behaviour to continue. I had become part of the lie. Confronting him on this and issues of trust regularly was our dance over the years, to which I would get no specific, honest, or even any response. With a bottle of wine under his belt, there'd be overt displays of caring and brotherly solidarity, and by the next day I'd find Mr. Paleface present but absent again, a complete 180 that left me feeling woozy. It was all getting far too weird. All I can say is, at some point we draw the line, and I'd had enough. I was weary of policing his behaviour and playing substitute daddy. I began distancing myself from him and his antics. I changed moving companies and was frequently out to his phone calls. We started to drift. I met his songwriting partner a few months after my decision to split and was surprised to learn they had gone their separate ways too. I had seen him many times, but always in the presence of Flamenco Boy. Here was an opportunity to get another side of the story. First of all, I gotta know, dude, who was Rage and who was Silence? So he told me the story. The story of him, Flamenco, and their music against the world. They were like brothers. No one who'd defend you more, he said. But ultimately, R&S was a deceitful person. He did not outright lie. He'd just leave out crucial pieces of information. And because it was not 100%, it felt like a lie. He was very clever at sucking you in. And once you were in, very difficult to get out. Apparently, they split up and got back together many times. The last time they tried to repair the damage, Flamenco was toasted, slurring words, trying to check himself. The singer had a moment of clarity. One simple incident for the light to go on, and he realized that our man would never ever change. But he was hanging on to a dream. He didn't want their music to end, but this was the final straw. He didn't have the energy for himself and Flamenco's destructive ways anymore. "I just ran out of steam, dude." Ha! He was describing a carbon copy of my relationship with R&S. Amazing. Ultimately, he was relieved it was all over and was upbeat about future projects. We wished each other well and said goodbye. I watched him walk away and felt sad. I just ran out of steam. It's so difficult to build something bright, full of a wonderful energy. It is even more so to leave when it has turned into an ugly can of worms. It takes a certain kind of strength to acknowledge that change. Most of us hang on till the death, because it's the easier, familiar thing to do, and since our courage has deserted us, Last I heard, flamenco boy married a woman who fairly much fitted the required physical, emotional and financial stereotype. She went to work. He stayed home and cooked, cleaned, drank red wine and played the guitar. Analysis. He came from hard-working blue-collar parents in a tough Midwestern city. His puritanical mother clearly played a part in the way he reacted to controlling women later in life. No doubt her fervent guilt regarding sexual matters had an effect too. He told me of a memory he had of her, on her knees praying over him, that he should be granted strength to resist temptation of the forbidden and dirty deed until marriage. Hey, Zeus! When he came to LA, instead of returning to his old gig of giving guitar lessons, he got into selling naked pictures of himself to skin magazines. There were veiled references to porno movies, in which his inferred participation was accompanied by a nod and a wink. He occasionally expressed an attraction for a transsexual in a film or magazine, and sported a dress code that revealed the bulge of his manliness, and I don't mean his wallet, the male camel toe, all too frequently. His predilection for a shorn, boyish look in a woman was the antithesis to his visual of a smooth-jowled visage and flowing locks. Hair, by the way, that was luxuriant and beautifully maintained, often admired by women. At times he would pull it back with a horseshoe headband in that peculiarly feminine manner. He was content with the role reversal of playing house husband to a woman with a career. He loved to cook and entertain and had a meticulous passion for cleaning, an interest that few heterosexual men I've ever met have for furnishings, fabrics and design was a bit of a red flag, sexually repressed or extremely liberated. You decide, dear listener. I'm not saying a word. Mr. Paleface, when present, reminded me of a wounded animal. One that is in a lot of pain and will lash out, but is fiercely protective when its own are threatened. He needed a lot of attention and support. Physically abused, emotionally neglected as a child? He joined gang life early on and was involved in extreme exchanges with rival factions. After a while, he grew bored of these rituals and aspired to a more evolved existence. He developed an appreciation for good food and wine, and read up on history, politics, art, and of course music. He studied different styles, Eastern, classical, contemporary, bluegrass, jazz, blues, rock and roll, etc., and blended them all with his manic and fragile personality. His ticket out of the whole mess, looks and a talent for the acoustic guitar. The final reason to leave came when his best friend died in his arms from a knife wound during a gang confrontation. He left for the romantic future that Hollywood could offer. The world would be his oyster. He arrived in this city in the great rock and roll tradition, at the bus station, pretty much penniless, except for his beloved six-string. He disowned everything and everybody, including family, mom, dad, and brothers, that linked him to his past. This was the new world. Here he could be anything he wanted, and took full advantage. Towards the end of our friendship, my parents came to visit. We received an invitation to dine with him and his girlfriend. I was unsure whether to accept, as our relationship was on the way out. I did not want to subject my folks to any of his nonsense. However, he insisted on meeting them. I sensed he would have been mortified had I declined. So I girded my loins and prepared my dad to be on guard. Instead, our man was the perfect host. A terrific meal cooked by his own hand and carefully picked wines, candlelit atmosphere and music by Sinatra. He was accommodating regarding the infamous British palate. Easy on the garlic, son, a warning from Par Q. Flamenco was deferential to the unassuming couple who'd served their country in World War II, full of questions and thoughtful response regarding this turbulent period in history. The dinner was a high point of their visit here. Everyone had a great time. My feelings about the evening were mixed. I was touched by the warmth he showed my folks. But as I joined in the spirit of the occasion, I felt like a phony, knowing the whole cynical story. I regretted having expressed such reservations to my dad. I felt like an ingrate, though was undeniably justified in doing so. Such a spread. You could say he played the dutiful son, and yet... I remember the manager at work informing me of three letters he'd received from Flamenco's mother, all addressed to her boy, care of the company. RNS refused to accept them. A fourth was sent to the office direct, pleading for information as to the whereabouts of her son who'd been silent for many years. She was heartbroken. How she knew his work location, I don't know, but it was the last known address she had. Flamenco boy. Definitely the soul of a type B with some C characteristics.